set of trees at a particular velocity on their automobile, and the sun is shining through the trees, and they're seeing the sun flickering at a particular rate, they get that either a sick feeling or a psychedelic feeling. Certain rates at which you can flash light into a human eye, and you get some peculiar responses. KJ, KQRIW.
KQRIW, KTJ. Actually, you can cause epilepsy to occur at the specific frequency. Actually, when you go to the movie theater, you think you're watching 24 frames per second, watching 48 frames per second, twice to eliminate the perception of flicker. Actually, you come over to the TV station, I'll show you some 50 years of them. Watch the NHK on one of the satellites when they transmit. Get off the plane in
Gatwick.
Lights seem to flicker. Actually, everything flickers. But when you're watching television and you become adjusted to it, something that has a very white spot, the highest brightness point on the screen, it happens to be somewhere in the center and it's very large. But after you've acclimated, you will, but it's just at the border point where perception could see flicker faster and it goes away.
Psychedelic effect. So, I was familiar that motion pictures, movies, 24 frames per second, the camera flashes it on the screen, 23 frames, 48 frames per second, and therefore you don't see any flicker unless there's rapid motion, like wagon wheels that are turning, you'll see orthoscopic effects, or again, if you're up close to the screen and rapid motion is taking place, the picture appears to move and jog, it moves in funny steps, so you can sense that the something peculiar is going on with the frame rate versus the action rate. Okay, the next person who signed in with a real question was John, KC2WGV. I think you said you've got an antenna question. One of our favorite subjects, Eric. I mean, John, KC2WGV, K2RIW on the TechNet.
You're forgetting.
Yeah, he signed in after John. John signed in earlier with his question, so it's in that order. Go ahead, John.
Did you want to take WW first, John? I'm all right. That first, it might be quicker. Mine's a little.
Okay. Tony, you're up at bat. You've become number one on the runway, says Tony. Whiskey, whiskey, two whiskey. K2RIW on the tech net. One last call. Tony, are you still there? WW2W, K2RIW. Maybe he got called away. When he comes back, we'll listen to him. John, you're the man. KC2WGV, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Right. I'm trotting at 100 square feet. Cardinal point horizontal. You're pointing to side.
Yes, I do. To review what you said at first, is that almost all antennas, the signal coming out of the antenna, we rate it as isotropic equivalent radiated power, EIRP. Equivalent isotropic radiated power. So you first assume the antenna is lighting up the whole sphere. Ordinary light bulb in the middle of a spherical reality, your real antenna cases aims the signal like a flashlight. It obeys the conservation of energy law. So instead of lighting up all 100 square feet of your dome in your example, but if we want to light up 1 square foot, and we'd have 100 times more power, 20 dB. I might put 1 watt into the antenna, but it's going to look like 100 watts coming out, because in the direction of the 1 square foot, that's where I'm putting all my power, and the other 99 square feet, I'm not putting any power there. I'm not violating any conservation of energy laws when I do that. I can now take that sphere, and I slice it right through the equator, and I can decide that I'm only going to feed the lower hemisphere, and I'm not going to feed the other hemisphere. Again, I can do that with antenna pattern adjustment. If I've got enough knobs on the antenna, I can do that. And so far, I'm with you. Go ahead, John.
Okay, now we part the points. Now we're going to take the knife out, raise it 45, rotate that sphere, eyelid that could be open.
Yes, I do. And whether you do it by cutting your sphere with a knife, or whether you do it by having a phased array antenna, adjusting the electronic beam width, you can decide how many square feet of that sphere your antenna is going to send signal through, decide how many dB down are the side lobes, or what's the front-to-back ratio, or in ideal world, you can light up whichever number of square feet you want to, or square inches that you want to, and send essentially no signal to all the others. And you're not violating conservation of energy. If you're lighting up only 1% of the total sphere, in theory you've now got a 100-to-1 ratio of the power in the desirable direction versus the isotropic power. So, yes, if I slice it in the way you describe, from side view, it looks like an eye. So, again, there's going to be some number of square feet where there really is signal. And once I know the ratio of the area that I'm really illuminating versus the total area of the whole sphere, that allows me to describe the directivity and or gain of the antenna. And there's some reasonable mathematics that handles that. Over to you, John.
Lift that eyelid, and that portion of it has a signal path. I'll be vertically polarized, because what about the perturbative problem? Now, I also reflector, we should have this.
Yes, it does, and I'm gonna anticipate where you're going, and I'm going to jump ahead. First of all, we started off with a very simple antenna that's easy to understand mathematically, isotropic. A perfectly round white light bulb in the middle of a spherical room. By simple example, I adjusted the radius of the room, 100 square feet of area, and I'm putting 100 watts into the light bulb, and therefore I've got 1 watt per square foot on the sphere. I could, if I want to, double the radius of that sphere, so that instead of having 100 square feet, it's got 200 square feet. And I could rework the mathematics accordingly. I don't have to change the antenna pattern in any way. For simplicity reasons, I made it a 100 square foot round room, and we talked about watts per square foot. And in my simple example of a 100 watt light bulb, I had 1 watt per square foot. Let me drop. Reality, that is a easily viewed area relationship of a spherical room. Real world, it's an angular relationship. Real world, from the phase center of the antenna, looking out at that room, or looking out at the universe, if I remove the room, I'm lighting up some number of square degrees. 41,253, approximately, square degrees on the surface of a sphere. I take my globe, and I very carefully cut it up into 1 degree squares, and I count them all up. It's a lot easier to do this mathematically than reality. Take my word for it, it's 41,253. So, that's the number of real square degrees there are on the surface of the sphere. If I divide it up the way I did with this 1 square foot of this room, I've got 1% of 41,000. That's 412.5 square degrees. When I chose 1 square foot of the room, I'm really lighting up 412 square degrees. I can take the square root of 412. I'm guessing somewhere around 15. So I've got 15 degrees horizontal, 15 degrees vertical is the area I'm lighting up of the room, but now I've reconverted it into degrees. So a real antenna lights up some number of square degrees in space. You can call it stair radians, you can call it square degrees, you can give it all kinds of units. Let me drop. So if I have enough freedom in the antenna, I can describe exactly how many square feet of the room or exactly how many square degrees I'm lighting up, and in theory I light up nothing else. On top of that, if I'm a smart enough designer, signal that comes out of the antenna in any of those directions, in theory I can independently sense polarization. I could decide I'm going to transmit the signal out of 1 square foot forward and 1 square foot reverse. In theory, I can make the 1 square foot forward a vertically polarized signal. The 1 square foot of area at the back of the antenna, I can make it a horizontally polarized signal. In theory, I can do that. I have complete independence of setting the polarization in the design of the emitting device even before I decide how many square degrees of lighting up. And in the real world, let's assume now I'm trying to light up 1 square foot, 412 square degrees in the forward direction. I'm lighting it up with horizontal polarization. And the real antenna has got some side lobes that are 15 or 18 or 20 dB down, and I could have some other polarization on those side lobes. You've got the freedom to do that. There's only one catch. Let me drop it. That is, if I was really doing it with a spherical room where I cut some holes in the room and I allow the signal to squirt out of those holes, and the rest of the room is absorber, I've done as much as I can with the pattern of the design of the antenna. I've just selected the pattern in such a way that it's lighting up this 1 square foot out in front, and I'm hoping that the pattern lights up no other portions of the sphere. I've made the rest of the sphere absorptive. Reality has got some side lobes and back lobes, which I couldn't knock down as far as I want to, but I get it by making the sphere absorptive, and I've got the square hole 1 square foot in the front where I'm letting the signal out. And I've got complete polarization control at the antenna itself with one catch. That is the hole that I've lighted up, the hole that I've cut in the sphere, the 1 square foot hole in my example. If that hole was a large number of wavelengths horizontally and a large number of wavelengths vertical, because I'm using a wavelength that's very small compared to my 1 foot horizontal, 1 foot vertical of the real hole, no problem. As the hole starts approaching very small number of wavelengths, now I'm going to get into some diffraction effects. Now I think I'm lighting up 15 degrees horizontal and 15 degrees vertical, and I'm lighting up this 1 square foot hole, but if that hole is only half a wavelength horizontal and half a wavelength vertical, I've got another set of restrictions that Mother Nature is going to lay on me. I can't create a whole lot of directivity, a whole lot of pattern control, unless the emitting surface of the antenna, maybe it's the mouth of a horn, unless the mouth of a horn has a significant number of wavelengths of horizontal width and vertical width, let me drop, then all of these great degrees of directivity I desire come impossible. If I'm making a very simple pyramidal horn, and if the mouth of the horn has some number of wavelengths of horizontal and some number of wavelengths of vertical, let me make it 10 wavelengths horizontal and 10 wavelengths vertical. I've made the horn big enough. I selected the frequency of operation so that the mouth of the horn, which is that forward hole in the sphere, so to speak, I've chosen a horn antenna to do that. That horn is now looking out that hole in the center of the sphere, the 1 square foot hole, and I've adjusted things that the mouth of the horn is 10 wavelengths wide and 10 wavelengths high. I've made the horn big enough. I've chosen the frequency. I've made that happen. A simple rule of thumb is you take the number 70, divided by the number of wavelengths, that's the best beam width you're going to get. I said I made the horizontal width 10 wavelengths, the vertical width 10 wavelengths. I divide 10 into 70, I end up with 7. I will have no better than 7 degrees of horizontal beam width and 7 degrees of vertical beam width. Rough rule of thumb, take the number of wavelengths of the emitting surface, the emitting aperture, which in my case of a pyramid horn is the mouth of the horn. I put my ruler across the mouth of the horn, and I measure inches. I convert it to wavelength. Divide that number into 70. That's the best number of degrees of wavelength you're going to do. Comes out to be 7 degrees of beam width in my example, horizontal beam width and vertical beam width. And I want it to be 5 degrees of beam width. Cannot do that without making the horn bigger. You must obey this stuff. Number of wavelengths divided into 70. That's the best directivity you're going to get. And by the way, within reason, I can do that with any polarization you desire. I can make it circular, clockwise, counterclockwise, elliptical. I can make it horizontal, vertical, slant 45, clockwise, counterclockwise. As long as I'm not violating those wavelength numbers for the beamwidth that I'm requesting, I can give you essentially any pattern, any beamwidth, any polarization you want with some of the basic restrictions that I'm giving you some hints about right now. The first time you hear all this, I know it's overly complicated. You're going to have to hear it a couple of times before it makes sense. But with a 1-inch horn operating at 432 megacycles with a wavelength of 27 inches, I'm not going to get a 1-degree beamwidth no matter how much I jump up or down, if you know what I mean, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech man.
KC2.
Glenn recognized, but John first. Go ahead, John.
No.
And now we've got to go from my very simplistic artificial world into the real world. I set the radius of the dome such that it had 100 square feet of area because I was putting 100 watts into the light bulb, and I wanted the power flux density on the walls of the spherical room, 1 watt per square foot. False those numbers. So the radius of the room that does that is artificial construct just to make it understandable. That room is never really there. Antenna is lighting up some number of degrees of horizontal beam width, some number of degrees of vertical beam width. The antenna is sending out a pattern which has some number of degrees of horizontal and vertical beam width. There really isn't that room there. That room is just to try to understand power flux density. Real world doesn't have that room. Maybe that helps a little bit, John. Go ahead.
Okay, Dick, I understand. What I was asking is right design of an antenna.
Okay, you decided to construct, you decided to control the pattern out of the antenna by cutting a hole in the spherical room just right and letting the signal out in that direction and stopping it in all other directions. I went the next step. I recognized your hole in the spherical room. I took the phase center of the antenna, and that became the throat of a pyramid-shaped horn. I put straight, flat sides from that phase center of the antenna out towards the perimeter of the room where you've cut this hole, and I filled it up with a pyramid-shaped horn. I've now got a metallic, four metallic sheet, right angles to each other almost, coming from the center of the antenna. Mouth of this horn is now coming out the hole in the spherical room, and I haven't changed anything. Once I've designed that horn, the horn itself, I can make it with double ridge waveguides. I can make corrugations on the inside. I can do all kinds of fancy things on the center of that horn between the throat and the mouth. And depending on how I set up the probes in there and all these other doodads and lenses and whatever that I put inside that horn, in theory, I have complete freedom of what polarimetry comes out of the horn, what beamwidth comes out of the horn, what frequencies, what gain. In theory, I've got all of those controls with a couple of exceptions. Let me drop. And that is the final mouth of the horn, the biggest opening of the horn, where it launches the signal into free phase. Tell me how many wavelengths at your frequency of operation is the horn's width of its mouth, and how many wavelengths is the height of its mouth. I take each of those numbers of wavelengths, divide it into 70, tells how many degrees of beam width I'm going to get out of that antenna. You could very logically think to yourself that the angle of the horn, when I look at the horn side view, and I look at the angle from the antenna, which is at the throat of the horn, towards the mouth of the horn, I look at that angle, it's very easy to assume that at that angle is the beam width of what comes out of the horn. In general, that is not true. What comes out of that horn, you tell me the number of wavelengths, horizontal and vertical, I'll tell you what beam width the horn is capable of issuing. I don't care if you've made the horn a mile long, where now the angle of the horn is almost two parallel plates. No angle at all. And you think you're going to get a 0.5 degree beam width out of that horn just because you've made the horn very long? Absolutely not. The number of wavelengths of the emitting surface of the horn determines the best directivity you're going to get. Smart enough with the doodads you put in the horn, I've got complete control of polarization of what comes out of the horn. Let's see what Glenn wants to know about all this. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the tech dad. Wait for the beep.
My question is really got to do with the pattern of... I kind of understand that, but I would think that if I'm looking at that wall, that really exists.
Now, you've asked the beauty of a question. The sun is, with rare exceptions, depending on my fine degree of analysis, the sun is a truly isotropic radiator. So, 10 to the 27 watts every second of time. 10 to the 27 watts is coming out of the sun. It's going to do it for 10 to the 10 years. At your and my distance from the sun, 93 million miles, we get roughly 1.3 kilowatts per square meter of isotropic signal. Now if you start asking, what is the polarity of the signal coming out of the sun? Only define polarity, whether it's horizontal, vertical, clockwise, counterclockwise, when you define the frequency or wavelength of observation. I decide I'm going to analyze it at 550 nanometers, yellow-green line in the middle of the optical band where your eye is most sensitive, 550 nanometers. Let me drop. So I make a very narrow filter at 550 nanometers, and I aim it at the sun, and I start measuring polarimetry. What do I see? Substantial amount of horizontal, vertical, full amount of slant 45 right, slant 45 left, substantial amount of clockwise, I'll see a substantial amount of counterclockwise. I'll have almost no polarimetry favored polarization. You say to yourself, what in the world's going on? Realize that the sun as an emitter is not a coherent emitter. Pure black body thermal radiator. We can find out how much power is coming out of the sun at each individual wavelength. We can plot that curve. It's a great big broad curve. It isn't DC to light. It's D to X-ray, gamma ray, cosmic ray. It's got all. We can talk about how much power flux density is coming out at each one of those wavelengths. In order for you to calculate how much power is coming out of the sun, you have to define, okay, what's my wavelength of observation? Just like when you look at random noise coming out of an amplifier and you're looking at it on a spectrum analyzer. You can't describe the noise power. You might see on the screen, I see minus 85 dBm of noise. Let me drop. I've got my spectrum analyzer properly calibrated. I'm looking at the output of an amplifier. I measure minus 85 dBm of average noise power. I haven't told you anything until I told you the bandwidth of resolution bandwidth of observation. If I'm using the 1 megacycle filter, and I'm telling you I'm getting a power, noise power of minus 85 dBm per megacycle of random noise, now I've told you something. But because the noise is random, because it is not coherent, there's no clear sine wave in there, no matter how you look at it. You need a narrow enough filter, you're ringing your filter like a bell, and you think you see a sine wave. You're seeing the sine wave of excitation of your super narrow filter. The real emitter, the noise emitter of that amplifier, is not doing that. The sun is not doing that. The sun is not a coherent emitter. Once you go to non-coherence, talk about power flux density, if you talk about the bandwidth or the wavelength of the bandwidth wavelength of that you're looking at, I might add up all the sun's power between 550 and 560 nanometers. In that bandwidth, I'm measuring how much noise power I've got. But because it's a random noise emitter, non-coherent, it has no polarization. I could force the polarization by putting a Polaroid filter between it, but as a natural emitter, it doesn't do that. Now you go over to something that is coherent. Your light-emitting diode, which is a kind of a laser, or your real laser, depending on how you define and design that laser. Now, in theory, I can make that laser pure horizontal, pure vertical, pure clockwise, and so on. Once I've got coherence, once I've got a reasonably narrow band sine wave coming out of the emitting device, now I can start defining bandwidth and the power bandwidth, and I start defining a polarization and so on. But a random thermal noise emitter has no real polarimetry. So I can take a little round black dot and put it in the middle of the room and heat it up with my blowtorch so it's glowing white hot. That's a thermal emitter. And that could be very close to isotropic. But now I force the signal coming out of your synthesized signal generator set at 432.00 megahertz. And I put that into a so-called isotropic antenna because I've now got a coherent signal generator and a defined relatively narrow bandwidth. That's what coherence really is, kind of bandwidth defined by center frequency. Call it Q if you like. Now that I've got a clearly defined narrow bandwidth, which I'm in most circles calling it coherent, now I can define polarimetry. Now, in theory, I can make a horizontal antenna. Can I make the antenna horizontally polarized and isotropic? No. Make it circular and isotropic? No. So the so-called isotropic antenna, if I put my constraint on the design of the antenna, that it's going to be a coherent sine wave, a signal going into it, isotropic is the pattern, some defined polarization of how it lights up the equator and the poles and everything else of that sphere. I've now got an over-constrained problem. You can't do that. I can't make isotropic with anything that you and I can define as polarization. The simplest antenna you and I can think of is I set up a horizontal dipole, and I put it in that sphere, and the horizontal dipole is parallel to the equator. Right-hand inside of the dipole is at the prime meridian in England, and the left-hand side of it is at the international date line over there in the Pacific. So I've got that dipole in the middle of the sphere, and you and I know what that pattern looks like. Amplitude-wise, it's a donut-shaped pattern where the peak of the donut goes through the North Pole, the South Pole, and it goes through the 90-degree latitude and the 270-degree latitude. That's the peak of the donut. And along that donut, anywhere along that donut, I view it from that angle, I will see what I can call horizontal polarization. End of the wire, looking at the prime meridian and looking at the national date line along the equator, there's a deep null in that direction. And everywhere in between at crazy angles, I can define the polarization, but I can't make it the same polarization from every angle of observation on that simple dipole. And I start curving that dipole into all kinds of crazy ways, and I think I'm going to get a better control of the pattern. So, isotropic, purely defined polarization. By the way, to truly make a coherent isotropic antenna, almost impossible. Beautiful mathematical construct allows you to rate the gain of the antenna by comparison to isotropic. But the truly truly isotropic antenna doesn't exist, and if it doesn't exist, I can't even go the next step of defining its isotropic polarization characteristic. No, it's not the whole story. Maybe it helps a little bit, Glenn. KUIQ, K2RIW.
That's very good, Dick. Thanks for the explanation. That's written not very, very well. A lot of text from an isotropic radiator.
Now let me correct some of what I've said. I gave you a very simplistic answer about the sun. You and I are looking at the sun all at once. It's shining a white piece of paper in the backyard. By some means, we're trying to measure 1,300 watts per square meter. We're trying to measure polarization. If I now use a really good high-resolution telescope, where I can now look at 1 millidegree of the sun at a time. And that, the sun is really half a degree wide and half a degree high. It's a circle half a degree wide. But I've now got a telescope that can look at a very small fraction of that. And on the average day, there's some sunspots. Sunspots are the location where there's a very strong local magnetic field coming up to the surface of the sun. And now with my high-resolution telescope, I start looking at the center of one of those sunspots. Start measuring polarimetry. Because of that strong local magnetic field, because of the Zeeman effect and all of the kinds of things going on, I will see favored polarization. But the right kind of instrumentation, I can measure the emission from the sun across that sunspot, and I can now make a picture of what polarization on each milliradian is coming out of that particular portion of the sunspot. So now when you start getting down to the fine nitty-gritty of the individual little pixels on that sun, there is definitely polarization characteristics caused by that local magnetic field, even though it's an incoherent radio. You start using the right instrumentation where I can start looking at the fine details. There is polarization in everything. When I look at the signal coming out of that star called Cygnus X, right kind of instrumentation, because of the local magnetic field around that star, because of the way it lights up a gas cloud near it and whatever, there are favored polarization.
Interesting.
And is that really an isotropic radiator? Yeah, but there's lots of polarization going on there. Go ahead, Wesley, K2RIW.
Yeah, interesting. I would like you just to give me words about what you just said. There was, that because of the influence of the magnetic field, photons, we might stand immune in theory to the magnetic field, are being polarized. And to exist.
The one possible explanation for what causes sunspots. Sun is one hell of a big, very hot ball of plasma, highly, highly conductive, volumetric, gaseous material. One great big fuzzball. I mean, the pounds per square foot, pounds per cubic foot of the sun, it's fairly light material because it's very hot and spread out very far. So this plasma has some huge magnetic field probably emanating from the sun, but I don't know that. Center of the sun is rotating at one rate. The perimeter of the sun is rotating at another rate. And even if I talk about the perimeter of the sun, rate at which it is rotating near the equator and the weight that is rotating near the poles are very different rates. So you get the strong generator of magnetic fields in the center and at these various rotational rates, so that magnetic field propagating through the various layers of the sun wound up like a spring. One possible explanation is that once every 11 years, that spring winds up so tight, the spring essentially breaks and starts the process all over again, and that's the next sunspot cycle. That's one very simplistic possible explanation for what's going on. And as those individual magnetic lines wind up, come up to the surface, interact in very complicated ways, believed by me, and I think I've read it in a few places, that the individual magnetic fields as they come up to the surface are the major causative agents of what you and I call sunspots. And each of the sunspots are where the signal, the bubbling, the oatmeal that's bubbling up from the bottom, the oatmeal bubbles that are bubbling up from the bottom of the sun come up to the surface. They get deflected in a funny way, and those sunspots are places where the local temperature is something like 1,000 or 1,500 or even 2,000 degrees cooler than the rest of the spot around it. The sunspots look black. They really are very bright, but by comparison, they're black because they're maybe 1,500 or 2,000 degrees cooler because of what the magnetic field is doing with that energy that's bubbling up from the sun. So the local magnetic field and the cooler sunspots, and by the way, I'm calling the sunspots black because when you take a picture with your telescope across the sun, you see them as black spots. Turns out that the moon is also very black. Took a well-calibrated picture of the moon. The moon is only a 7% reflector. The moon has approximately the same reflectivity as the black macadam, the black asphalt, that's in that parking lot. It's in front of those stores that you go to in that shopping center. If you looked at, with a calibrated camera, look at the light reflected off that black top that's in the parking lot of your nearest food emporium. Moon is approximately that exact amount of illumination. But because the moon is being bathed in sunlight at high noon, because your photograph compares it against a really black sky, it has almost white material. It's very dark material. Okay, by the same token, those sunspots, let me drop this, are something like 1,500 degrees cooler. But the local magnetic field in the vicinity of those sunspots is lighting up this plasma. The plasma is re-emitting a kind of a black body radiating material. But that black body radiating material is obeying the Zeeman effect, among other effects. What that really means is that a plasma material in the presence of a magnetic field knits with a favored polarization. On top of that, the Zeeman effect also tells you that the simple line of emission, maybe if it's hydrogen-like material, and you know what line, I think it's roughly 1,520 megacycles, I think it is. Yeah, I think it's 1,520 megacycles is the so-called hydrogen alpha line. Presence of a magnetic field, that simple line breaks up into, we call it two side lobes. There's a line higher in frequency and a line lower in frequency because of the Zeeman effect and the local magnetic field causing that. So the local magnetic field is taking your simple line of emission, breaking it up into multiple lines, and creating an emission that has favored polarization characteristics. I'm overly simplifying a very complicated issue that I only partially understand. Maybe that helps a little bit, though, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Interesting. Very well, I still have a problem with a few statements of yours, and it is probably because of my lack of understanding all of the knowledge in this area, and I believe that it would be good if we could have the supporting material, since we're dealing with the energy and energy propagation and the properties of energy vector.
Let me finish with John's question. So, John, I know that with your eyelash side view, you thought that the hole cut in the sphere was controlling the pattern. In reality, in the real world, you view it with a pyramid-shaped horn is one way of designing the antenna. Theory, you're trying to control what beam width is coming out of the antenna and what polarization, which is the way you lit up the probes at the throat of the horn. And the mouth of the horn is what really determines what bandwidth, what beam width you're able to get horizontally and vertical. And you've got enough smarts in the way you design the antenna, independently defined, within reason, as long as you've devoted enough real estate to this phased array, we'll say, determine what beam width, bandwidth, polarization, directivity, gain, set all of those things in the design of the antenna. The design of the antenna to understand what it does when it radiates into space, we can use this construct of a spherical room to figure out how it's lighting up the walls of the spherical room. In reality, the spherical room is not there. The antenna is lighting up some number of horizontal and vertical degrees of space. Solid angle degrees is what the antenna really does. and as long as you obey the laws of conservation of energy, how much energy you're putting out forward versus out back, how many watts you've got to radiate, how you design the antenna for those beamlets and polarization characteristics, you've got a lot of freedom there. There's over 5,000 kinds of antennas that you can see by opening up the antenna engineering handbook. And that's just the ordinary, let me drop this. That's just the ordinary antennas, and there's a whole set of duplicate antennas where you do the opposite. You use Babnet's rule. I can take a piece of wire in space, and everything around it is insulated space, and I can build an antenna. And I can do the exact opposite. I start off with a sheet of metal, goes to infinity in every direction, and I cut a slot in it where the wire used to be. I've now got the converse or inverse antenna. So for every real antenna, there's an inverse antenna. If I've got 5,000 real antennas, I've got 5,000 converse antennas. I've got 10,000 antennas. Got a lot of choices. Didn't say it's easy. Got a lot of knobs on that piece of equipment, if you know what I mean, John. ACWGB, K2LIW.
Very well, Dick. Very interesting. Find out the amount of roughly you need.
I think you've got it. You tell me how many wavelengths there is across the horizontal dimension of the horn, and divide that into 70, that tells you about the best you're going to do in horizontal beamwidth. Tell me how many wavelengths you've got in vertical extent of the mouth of the horn, divide that number of wavelengths into 70, and I'll tell you how many vertical beamwidth is the best you're going to do. And there's one or two other assumptions here, and that is you're assuming that the aperture distribution is almost uniform. In other words, if the mouth of my horn is 12 inches wide and 12 inches high, I'm assuming that each square inch is getting roughly the same power. If I'm only putting power in the center couple of square inches and nothing out of the edge, well, I really got a much smaller horn, and the total number of wavelengths I'm lighting up is really a much smaller number. I'm going to get a broader beamwidth. You're amazed how many people look at the fire hose effect, and they get it backwards. Amazed how many people will say, I've got a round piece of waveguide. If I make the piece of waveguide long enough, I'm training the waves to go down this piece of waveguide, and when it comes out of the end, it's going to have very narrow beamwidth. And if I make the hose a little bit smaller in diameter, and I make the hose long enough, I'm going to have a more narrow beamwidth. That's exactly opposite of what Mother Nature really does. Make the hose larger and larger in diameter, your round waveguide, then the aperture at the end has got a larger and larger number of wavelengths of width and height to it. Therefore, it's capable of making a more narrow beamwidth, opposite of common sense. You're not training that wave. Amplitude distribution across the emitting surface and the phase distribution. Even if I'm taking this horn that I described before, where it's 12 inches wide, 12 inches high at the mouth, square inch has almost the same amount of power. Now, in theory, every one of those square inches should be in the same phase. If I design the doodads that are down that horn so that some of those square inches are in phase and some of them are out of phase, that's another more complicated thing. The beam is going to get more narrow. That's called beam spoiling when you do that. So my beam spoiling techniques of a phased array, I've got a whole bunch of little emitters across each one of those square inches. I don't light them up all with the same power, and I don't light them up all with the same phase. I can make the beam broader. Can't make it any more narrow than that 70-degree law that I just gave you. And the 70-degree law is a round-off. The real number is 57.4 degrees. Where does 57.4 come from? If I take 180 degrees and divide it by pi, I end up with 57.4, I think, is the number. If I had perfect amplitude distribution and perfect phase distribution across every square inch of the mouth of the horn, wouldn't be dividing into 70, it'd be dividing into 57.4. Now let's go to the real world. Real world, with my vertically polarized signal coming down my horn, I can't make a vertically polarized signal at the exact same amplitude on the left-hand vertical wall and the right-hand vertical wall along that horn. Parallel polarization waves must go to zero when it's parallel to a conductor. So as such, with any reasonable design of a horn, if I plot amplitude of the signal across the mouth of the horn, It looks like a rectified sine wave, a half sine wave. I've got maximum signal in the center, but on the left-hand edge for a vertically polarized signal, it goes to zero, and the right-hand edge, it goes to zero. Because of the real aperture amplitude distribution that I can realize in the real world, 57.4 goes up to 70. That's why you divide into 70. Good, round, figure, rule of thumb, approximation, good enough for most of the stuff you and I do. For most of the amplitude distribution, on most of the horns that you can operate on, and most of the dishes you're going to illuminate, and so on, parabolic dishes, I mean, you're up. Divide the number of wavelengths into 70, and you're within 5 or 10% error of the real world. It's a very good approximation. Now you know where the 70 came from. It's a fallback from 57.4, the magic number that converts, now called, that's it, converts radians and degrees. Got it. So use 70, because unless you're very smart with a lot of wavelengths to play with, you can't get down to the 57.4. In theory, if you had enough control, the real number would be 57.4. What if that makes a little more sense, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Good, Dick, because that all has to be.
Now, almost every passive antenna that you and I will ever see, touch, study, whatever, obeys reciprocity. That means as long as there's no active amplifier inside the antenna, as long as no circulator in the antenna, as long as everything is linear, I'm not arcing it over and whatever, I'm not making a plasma in the middle of the antenna, the whole issue itself. As long as I've got a really linear antenna, and I'm setting it up on my antenna range, and somebody says, well, should I measure the transmit pattern or should I measure the receive pattern of this unknown antenna? Yes. Measure whatever you want. Sit in the transmitting mode and a good anechoic chamber, and you measure the antenna pattern. Measure its beam width, its side lobe levels, its polarimetry, its front-to-back ratio. You measure everything you care about. And then I flip everything around. I use the antenna in the receive mode instead of the transmit mode. I will measure the exact same pattern, polarization, gain. Everything is the same. Whatever parameter you measure on transmit, you'll get the exact same parameter on receive. In the case of transmitting, it's not easy to figure out what the area is. In the case of receiving, on the case of a horn, I got a pyramid-shaped horn. I can put my ruler across the mouth of the horn. I can measure how much area is there. Because of the amplitude distribution that I just described to you before, that rectified sine wave, because the amplitude distribution is not thoroughly linear, because with any realistic design of a horn, the phase distribution is not perfectly zero everywhere, because of the real world of some phase variation and some amplitude variation. Measured 12 inches wide, 12 inches high, you think you've got 144 square inches of effective capture area of that horn. Then go out and measure the amount of signal the horn receives. You'll suddenly find out I got 68% of that number. I didn't get 100%. I've got 68% aperture efficiency as a receiver. But I've got no lossy material there. I can run this horn as a kilowatt. It runs ice cold when I'm transmitting. It's got 100% efficiency on transmit. And because of the law of reciprocity, why doesn't it have 100% efficiency on receive? You're amazed how many people cannot answer that question. The two statements I just gave you are the truth and not in violation. Let me up. When I transmitted with that horn, I put 100 watts into it, 99.9 watts got smeared into space somewhere. It has a certain horizontal beam width, certain vertical beam width, certain polarization characteristics, certain side lobe levels, and whatever. That's what it transmitted, and almost every single watt I put into that horn got transmitted. Now I want to do a reception test. I set up a transmitting antenna very far downrange, so I make sure I'm in the far field, because if you measure the antenna too close, you get patterns that are a lie unless you use a lot of mathematical correction procedures, near-field measurement correction procedures. So I'm transmitting a signal very far away. By the time the signal gets to my antenna, it is a thoroughly planar signal. Planar signal hits the mouth of the horn. Good common sense realizes it will lead you to believe that every bit of the signal that went down that 144 square inches of the mouth of the horn goes zigzagging down that horn, and all of it ends up into the throat of the horn, into the probe, and goes down into the receiver. Good common sense. It's that easy. Mother Nature says, whoa, wait a minute now. You violated some of my laws. Okay? Between the method that you use on transmitting and method that you use on receiving made a great big change. said, what do you mean? Put 100 watts into the transmitter, and I measured what went into space. 99.99 watts went into space. Then when I went into the receive mode, I put 100 watts into the probe antenna way down range, and I figured out how much I'm going to receive. I figured out how much free space loss. I calculate how much I get, and I only get 68%. What happened? Let me drop. In order to obey the law of reciprocity, you must duplicate everything. When that horn transmitted with a certain distribution in three-dimensional space, there was a peak of beam down the both side of the antenna. 25 degrees to the right, the beam is 25 degrees to the left, the beam is 25 degrees up, the beam is so on. There's a very specific pattern that horn had on transmit. And there was some side lobes, 17 dB down to the right, and 17 dB down to the left, 18 dB down above, and 18 dB down below. It is a certain front-to-back ratio. If I distribute enough transmitting signals in space so that on the reception mode, I duplicate that exact pattern it had on transmit. At every one of those angles, I transmit back into the horn on the reception mode exactly that amount of amplitude, exactly that amount of phase that it had when the horn was transmitting. I really duplicate everything. It takes a tremendous amount of resources to do that. If I did that, I now would be duplicating that amplitude distribution, phase distribution across the horn. Now, every bit of that signal would go down the horn, and it would appear to have 100% aperture efficiency. Don't see any more than 68% aperture efficiency, because you've done a simplistic test. You've used one single point source emitter downrange to send the signal back. That's not the pattern the antenna had on transmit. You violated reciprocity when you did your test in a very subtle way that very few people recognize. You got it, John.
Face the question to me.
Both
the two
horns. There's a yes and a no to that. If I put the two horns back together, mouth to mouth, and I put 1 watt into the first horn, I will measure 1 watt coming out of the second horn. The power transfer between the two, one horn is a kind of a colorimeter, a collimator for the other horn. However, there's a catch on this one. Many an antenna engineer will say, you violated one of the laws. In order to really measure the characteristics of an antenna, must be in its Fraunhofer zone, must be beyond its Fresnel zone. You must be in the far field. Far field is described as 2D squared of a lambda. Tell me the diameter of the antenna, that's the D, square it, multiply by 2, divide by wavelength. Theory, to really measure the pattern of the antenna, your measuring sensing equipment must be that far away. On that particular horn of mine, maybe I've got to be 25 feet away to really measure its pattern. Any closer than that, I get a pattern that's a lie. Beyond 25 feet, I measure the real pattern. So to be in the far field, to really measure the pattern, my particular horn, maybe I've got to be 25 feet away. When I put the two horns together, mouth to mouth, I'm way, way inside of the reactive near field of horn. Now what I measure requires a very different interpretation. So, the aperture distribution for the first horn is exactly what the second horn is going to see, because it is a 32nd of an inch away, if you know what I mean. So they are a collimator for each other, and now you have matched patterns. Absolutely. But because you've gone so far into the reactive near field of measurement, many an antenna engineer will say, yeah, what you measured is truthful and interesting, but not real. Well, there's a reality here. You've got to be careful how you use it. And when it comes to a 3-foot diameter dish used at 10 gigahertz, where the near field range is something like 90 feet, I have done the measurement where I put two dishes 5 feet apart, aimed at each other, put a milliwatt into one and measure 0.8 milliwatt coming out of the other. One's a collimator for the other. I've done that measurement. You've got to be careful how you interpret the result. I didn't really measure the pattern. I didn't really measure the pattern, and I didn't measure the gain. In the case of that 12-inch by 12-inch horn that I used as an example, might be a standard gain horn, might have a rated 15.5 dB of gain over isotropic, traceable to the bureau. Standard gain horn. I got 15 dB of gain out of the first horn, got 15 dB of gain out of the second horn, and I put the two together. Does that mean I'm going to get 30 dB of gain? If I put 1 milliwatt into one horn, I'm going to get a watt out of the other horn. Believe that, and I'm going to sell you a bridge the Verrazano Narrow Bridge that goes over to Staten Island. That's where the brain power is. Over to you, John. KC2WGV, K2LAW. In some respects, I could say all of the above, John. I had a thoroughly symmetrical square-throated horn down to a square mouth, taped horn, and I've got a vertical probe at the throat of the horn, waveguide section, that launches a vertically polarized wave. I've got a horizontal probe that launches a horizontal wave. I can put a probe in there at a 45-degree angle. I launch a slant 45-degree wave. Or I could simultaneously feed the horizontal probe and the vertical probe equal signal in phase. I'm now generating slant 45-degree polarization. I can feed the two probes equal power 90 degrees out of phase. Depending on which one leads and which one lags, I'm generating clockwise or counterclockwise circular polarization. So on most horns, the probe itself, the polarization of the probe is the primary determining factor of the polarization of what comes out of the horn. There's an exception. I could take the sheet metal of the horn, get it up to near the melting point, and I could twist the throat of the horn with reference to the mouth of the horn, twist the polarization and do some funny things. I can put a sheet of plastic down the horn as if I'm building double ridge waveguides. I got a piece of vertical plastic of some thickness and some dielectric constant. I can now make some changes of horizontal versus vertical, change the phasing of one versus the other. A piece of plastic is going to be a delay device. I can start twisting the piece of plastic, and I can do some funny polarization things. I can put two different pieces of plastic down there, one horizontal and one vertical, and shape them in such a way that even though I'm lighting up the two probes in phase, one piece of plastic has 90 degrees more delay than the other, and what finally gets radiated out of the mouth of the horn is going to be clockwise polarization. So I launched at the throat of the horn, I launched slant 45. I can start putting pieces of plastic inside the horn that act like a lens, look like a magnifying glass, and I can start now adjusting the time delay and the amplitude distribution. I can use lensing devices in the horn. I can make the lensing devices out of fancy-shaped pieces of metal, fancy-shaped pieces of plastic. The total number of variables you've got with a so-called simple pyramid-shaped horn, so I could make the width of the horn much wider than the height and vice versa. I can therefore have independent control of the horizontal beam width and the vertical beam width by just the way I shape the horn and whether or not the mouth of the horn is a narrow rectangle versus a square. You got a lot of knobs in your hand for guys to build a horn, and that's just one of the 5,000 kinds of antennas, John. Over to you, John, K2LIW. John first, and then Wesley in that order. Go ahead, John.
Wonderful subject, Dick. Coffee can. Thank you very much for the information.
Yeah, look out with horns. They can get you in trouble. When I was building the feed horn to listen to the Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 astronauts, my 12-foot diameter parabolic dish antenna that you can see August 1972 QSC magazine. It's on the front cover and the articles inside. 12-foot stress parabolic dish antenna. I'm building this compound feed horn of the Dr. Dick Turin design, W2IMU. And I needed a particular diameter of food can, round can. I got one 3 3/4 inch diameter for one of the cans. American paint can, the 12-inch diameter can, was just right. So I'm going up and down the aisles of the Bohack store. That was a brand name of a food emporium in downtown Farmingdale at the time, 1971. I'm with my ruler measuring the diameter of all the cans. I think Ralph Nader had already done this thing at the time. And so the manager of the store sees me measuring the diameter of all the cans. He's afraid that I'm about to greet some kind of a lawsuit. So he kicks me out of the store. And it turns out that the American diameter cans were all standardized, and the exact diameter I was looking for didn't exist. I finally went to the place in the Walt Whitman Shopping Center Mall, which is called Foods of All Nations, and found that the Scottish oatmeal can had just the right diameter. And I bought the Scottish oatmeal can, gave my wife the oatmeal, and started using the can, and the rest is history, and it became part of the article. So you decide to start building horns. You start deciding that nice round horns, you can save yourself a lot of labor by buying the right coffee can or Campbell's soup can or black bean can or whatever, or Scottish oatmeal can. You find the right diameter can, it'll save you a lot of labor. And don't worry about the fact that the can is made out of steel and you worry about the resistivity. and I was painting it with silver. I was painting it with Rust-Oleum silver paint to make it look good, and I worried about what was the loss of the paint. Lost a lot of sleep over that. Boy, was I wasting my time. Because the paint is less than a thousandth of an inch thick, and I was operating at 4.5-inch wavelength, so we're talking about a thousandth of a wavelength, or maybe 1/10,000th of a wavelength of thickness of paint. No matter how lossy I made the paint, no matter what I made it out of, I couldn't make the paint absorb that signal if I was trying to do the reverse problem of making it absorb. The steel itself is a little bit lower in conductivity than copper. I wondered, should I line the can with copper? The feed horn runs at such a low Q. It's such a broadband device. Current density on that can is so low that if you carefully measured with laboratory equipment, the insertion loss of the feed horn made out of steel cans with soldered joints probably had 0.01 dB of loss compared to a perfect silver-plated horn. Don't worry about it. These are minor details. Make it work first, then worry about those minor details later. Be amazed how many of these things I worried about. And I worried unnecessarily. The thing worked like a charm when we finally set it up, but I think I told you, to measure the pattern of the antenna, I needed an end chamber 700 feet long. And AIL's best multi-million dollar chamber was only 40 feet long. So I used the universe to measure the pattern. I aimed the antenna at the sun, measured sun noise versus sweeping the antenna, and I found out what the antenna pattern looked like and corrected it accordingly. QXJN, K2RIW, you got it, Wes. Just transmit on top of that. I can hear you on the input.
Okay. So, Jim. There are a few things that I have sent you, and there are three sequential emails that I have sent you. First, at the beginning, I would like to say that the information provided purely from the perspective of scientific investigation, it is only and directly snarled to the subject and not to an event that might be attached to. So, if such additional...
Yeah, I did see what they were talking about, instant rusting phenomena. I saw about these granulation and the way aluminum rods melt.
First, before that, I would like to start with the paper that was received at December 22nd of 1969. And this paper was declassified at May 6th of 2004. The paper comes from the Institute of Exploratory Research of U.S. Army Electronics Command for Malmö, New Jersey. And it states about the nuclear magnetic resonance analyzing a ferrite compound made out of barium, zinc, iron, and oxygen. And what it stands for is the spin echo spectrum, a broad line from 200 to 470 megahertz, was identified as manganium replacing iron. Now, we're not talking about a focus beam, we're talking about two frequencies in a certain respect, which one is spinning in the conic shape and the other one is simply the sine wave. Ladies and gentlemen, we're also talking about a factor that very narrow lines of 555 megahertz and 585 megahertz was causing manganium ions replacing zinc. Then we're just talking about that. We go to another link which says about the generation of metal cluster ion beams through post-discharge ionization and ablation. And everything of that is about examples of nuclear magnetic resonance in ferrite, replacement of metal compounds, ferrite, by ion caused by frequency. At the same time, a energy level of ferrite has changed, and everything is done by changing frequency oscillation. Now, the generation of metal cluster in ion beams was done by triggered spark gap switch, which was designed as used as a method of, for ionization of ablation, which is a Tesla experiment in modern times. But to you, sir.
That sounds like you're talking about a chemical-like change of the constituents of the ferrite as a function of certain frequencies of excitation. That change taking place while the ferrite is in a molten state or when one is in a cooled crystalline state, and the presence of the radio signal makes that change. Is that what you're saying? Go ahead.
Well, the experimentation was done in four.